will be the mere products of the imagination, in dreams as well as in madness, though indeed these are themselves created by the reproduction of previous external perceptions, which, as has been shown, are possible only through the reality of external objects. The sole aim of our remarks has, however, been to prove that internal experience in general is possible only through external experience in general. Whether this or that supposed experience be purely imaginary must be discovered from its particular determinations and by comparing these with the criteria of all real experience. Finally, as regards the third postulate, it applies to material necessity in existence and not to merely formal and logical necessity in the connection of conceptions. Now, as we cannot cognize completely a priori the existence of any object of sense, though we can do so comparatively a priori, that is, relatively to some other previously given existence, a cognition, however, which can only be of such an existence as must be contained in the complex of experience, of which the previously given perception is a part, the necessity of existence can never be cognized from conceptions, but always, on the contrary, from its connection with that which is an object of perception. But the only existence cognized, under the condition of other given phenomena as necessary, is the existence of effects from given causes in conformity with the laws of causality. It is, consequently, not the necessity of the existence of things as substances, but the necessity of the state of things that we cognize, and that not immediately, but by means of the existence of other states given in perception, according to empirical laws of causality. Hence, it follows that the criterion of necessity is to be found only in the law of possible experience, that everything which happens is determined a priori in the phenomenon by its cause. Thus, we cognize only the necessity of effects in nature, the causes of which are given us. Moreover, the criterion of necessity in existence possesses no application beyond the field of possible experience, and even in this it is not valid of the existence of things as substances, because these can never be considered as empirical effects, or as something that happens and has a beginning. Necessity, therefore, regards only the relations of phenomena according to the dynamical law of causality and the possibility grounded thereon of reasoning from some given existence of a cause a priori to another existence of an effect. Everything that happens is hypothetically necessary, is a principle which subjects the changes that take place in the world to a law that is, to a rule of necessary existence, without which nature herself could not possibly exist. Hence the proposition, nothing happens by blind chance, in mundo non datur casus, is an a priori law of nature. The case is the same with the proposition, necessity in nature is not blind, that is, it is conditioned, consequently intelligible necessity, non datur fatum. Both laws subject the play of change to a nature of things as phenomena, or, which is the same thing, to the unity of the understanding, and through the understanding alone can changes belong to an experience as the synthetical unity of phenomena. Both belong to the class of dynamical principles. The former is properly a consequence of the principle of causality, one of the analogies of experience. The latter belong to the principles of modality, which to the determination of causality adds the conception of necessity, which is itself, however, subject to a rule of the understanding. The principle of continuity forbids any leap in the series of phenomena regarded as changes, in mundo non datus saltus, and likewise, in the complex of all empirical intuitions in space, any break or hiatus between two phenomena, non datur hiatus. For we can so express the principle that experience can admit nothing which proves the existence of a vacuum, or which even admits it as a part of an empirical synthesis. For, as regards a vacuum or void, which we may cogitate as out and beyond the field of possible experience, the world, such a question cannot come before the tribunal of mere understanding, which decides only upon questions that concern the employment of given phenomena for the construction of empirical cognition. It is rather a problem for ideal reason, which passes beyond the sphere of a possible experience and aims at forming a judgment of that which surrounds and circumscribes it, and the proper place for the consideration of it is the transcendental dialectic. These four propositions, in mundo non dato hiatus, non dato saltus, non dato casus, non dato fatum, as well as all principles of transcendental origin, we could very easily exhibit in their proper order, that is, in conformity with the order of the categories, and assign to each its proper place. But the already practiced reader will do this for himself, or discover the clue to such an arrangement. But the combined result of all is simply this, to admit into the empirical synthesis nothing which might cause a break-in or be foreign to the understanding and the continuous connection of all phenomena, that is, the unity of the conceptions of the understanding. For in the understanding alone is the unity of experience, in which all perceptions must have their assigned place, possible. Whether the field of possibility be greater than that of reality, and whether the field of the latter be itself greater than that of necessity, are interesting enough questions, and quite capable of synthetic solution, questions, however, which come under the jurisdiction of reason alone. For they are tantamount to asking whether all things as phenomena do without exception belong to the complex and connected world of a single experience, of which every given perception is a part which therefore cannot be conjoined with any other phenomena, or whether my perceptions can belong to more than one possible experience. The understanding gives to experience, according to the subjective and formal conditions of sensibility as well as of apperception, the rules which alone make this experience possible. Other forms of intuition besides those of space and time, other forms of understanding besides the discursive forms of thought or of cognition by means of conceptions, we can neither imagine nor make intelligible to ourselves. And even if we could, they would still not belong to experience, which is the only mode of cognition by which objects are presented to us. Whether other perceptions besides those which belong to the total of our possible experience, and consequently, whether some other sphere of matter exists, the understanding has no power to decide, its proper occupation being with the synthesis of that which is given. Moreover, the poverty of the usual arguments which go to prove the existence of a vast sphere of possibility, of which all that is real, every object of experience, is but a small part, is very remarkable. All real is possible. From this follows naturally, according to the logical laws of conversation, the particular proposition, some possible is real. Now this seems to be equivalent to, much is possible that is not real. No doubt it does seem as if we ought to consider the sum of the possible to be greater than that of the real, from the fact that something must be added to the former to constitute the latter. But this notion of adding to the possible is absurd. For that which is not in the sum of the possible, and consequently requires to be added to it, is manifestly impossible. In addition to accordance with the formal conditions of experience, the understanding requires a connection with some perception. But that which is connected with this perception is real, even although it is not immediately perceived. But that another series of phenomena, in complete coherence with that which is given in perception, consequently more than one all-embracing experience is possible, is an inference which cannot be concluded from the data given us by experience, and still less without any data at all. That which is possible only under conditions which are themselves merely possible is not possible in any respect. And yet we can find no more certain ground on which to base the discussion of the question whether the sphere of possibility is wider than that of experience. I have merely mentioned these questions that in treating of the conception of the understanding there might be no omission of anything that, in the common opinion, belongs to them. In reality, however, the notion of absolute possibility, possibility which is valid in every respect, is not a mere conception of the understanding which can be employed empirically, but belongs to reason alone, which passes the bounds of all empirical use of the understanding. We have, therefore, contented ourselves with a merely critical remark, leaving the subject to be explained in the sequel. Before concluding this fourth section, and at the same time the system of all principles of the pure understanding, it seems proper to mention the reasons which induced me to term the principles of modality postulates. This expression I do not here use in the sense which some more recent philosophers, contrary to its meaning with mathematicians, to whom the word properly belongs, attach to it, that of a proposition, namely, immediately certain, requiring neither deduction nor proof. For if, in the case of synthetical propositions, however evident they may be, we accord to them without deduction and merely on the strength of their own pretensions unqualified belief, all critique of the understanding is entirely lost. And as there is no want of bold pretensions which the common belief, though for the philosopher this is no credential, does not reject, the understanding lies exposed to every delusion and conceit, without the power of refusing its assent to these assertions, which, though illegitimate, demand acceptance as veritable axioms. When, therefore, to the conception of a thing an a priori determination is synthetically added, such a proposition must obtain, if not a proof, at least a deduction of the legitimacy of its assertion. The principles of modality are, however, not objectively synthetical, for the predicates of possibility, reality, and necessity do not in the least augment the conception of that of which they are affirmed, inasmuch as they contribute nothing to the representation of the object. But as they are, nevertheless, always synthetical, they are so merely subjectively. That is to say, they have a reflective power, and apply to the conception of a thing, of which, in other respects, they affirm nothing, the faculty of cognition in which the conception originates and has its seat. So that if the conception merely agree with the formal conditions of experience, its object is called possible. If it is in connection with perception and determined thereby, the object is real. If it is determined according to conceptions by means of the connection of perceptions, the object is called necessary. The principles of modality therefore predicate of a conception nothing more than the procedure of the faculty of cognition which generated it. Now, a postulate in mathematics is a practical proposition which contains nothing but the synthesis by which we present an object to ourselves and produce the conception of it. For example, with a given line, to describe a circle upon a plane from a given point. And such a proposition does not admit of proof, because the procedure which it requires is exactly that by which alone it is possible to generate the conception of such a figure. With the same right, accordingly, can we postulate the principles of modality, because they do not augment, see footnote, the conception of a thing, but merely indicate the manner in which it is connected with the faculty of cognition. Footnote. When I think the reality of a thing, I do really think more than the possibility, but not in the thing, for that can never contain more in reality than was contained in its complete possibility. But while the notion of possibility is merely the notion of a position of a thing in relation to the understanding, its empirical use, reality is the conjunction of the thing with perception. General remark on the system of principles. It is very remarkable that we cannot perceive the possibility of a thing from the category alone, but must always have an intuition by which to make evident the objective reality of the pure conception of the understanding. Take, for example, the categories of relation. How, 1, a thing can exist only as a subject and not as a mere determination of other things, that is, can be substance, or how, 2, because something exists, some other thing must exist, consequently, how a thing can be a cause, or how, 3, when several things exist, from the fact that one of these things exists, some consequence to the others follows, and reciprocally, and in this way a community of substances can be possible, are questions whose solution cannot be obtained from mere conceptions. The very same is the case with the other categories. For example, how a thing can be of the same sort with many others, that is, can be a quantity and so on. So long as we have not intuition, we cannot know whether we do really think an object by the categories, and where an object can anywhere be found to cohere with them, and thus the truth is established that the categories are not in themselves cognitions, but mere forms of thought for the construction of cognitions from given intuitions. For the same reason is it true that from categories alone no synthetical proposition can be made. For example, in every existence there is substance, that is, something that can exist only as a subject and not as mere predicate, or everything is a quantity. To construct propositions such as these, we require something to enable us to go out beyond the given conception and connect another with it. For the same reason, the attempt to prove a synthetical proposition by means of mere conceptions, for example, everything that exists contingently has a cause, has never succeeded. We could never get further than proving that, without this relation to conceptions, we could not conceive the existence of the contingent, that is, could not a priori, through the understanding, cognize the existence of such a thing. But it does not hence follow that this is also the condition of the possibility of the thing itself that is said to be contingent. If, accordingly, we look back to our proof of the principle of causality, we shall find that we were able to prove it as valid only of objects of possible experience, and indeed only as itself the principle of the possibility of experience, consequently of the cognition of an object given in empirical intuition, and not from mere conceptions. That, however, the proposition, "everything that is contingent must have a cause," is evident to everyone merely from conceptions, is not to be denied. But in this case, the conception of the contingent is cogitated as involving not the category of modality, as that the non-existence of which can be conceived, but that of relation, as that which can exist only as the consequence of something else. And so it is really an identical proposition. That which can exist only as a consequence has a cause. In fact, when we have to give examples of contingent existence, we always refer to changes, and not merely to the possibility of conceiving the opposite. See footnote. But change is an event which, as such, is possible only through a cause, and considered per se, its non-existence is therefore possible, and we become cognizant of its contingency from the fact that it can exist only as the effect of a cause. Hence, if a thing is assumed to be contingent, it is an analytical proposition to say it has a cause. Footnote. We can easily conceive the non-existence of matter, but the ancients did not thence infer its contingency. But even the alternation of the existence and non-existence of a given state in a thing, in which all change consists, by no means proves the contingency of that state, the ground of proof being the reality of its opposite. For example, a body is in a state of rest after motion, but we cannot infer the contingency of the motion from the fact that the former is the opposite of the latter. For this opposite is merely a logical and not a real opposite to the other. If we wish to demonstrate the contingency of the motion, what we ought to prove is that, instead of the motion which took place in the preceding point of time, it was possible for the body to have been then in rest, not that it is afterwards in rest. For in this case, both opposites are perfectly consistent with each other. But it is still more remarkable that, to understand the possibility of things according to the categories, and thus to demonstrate the objective reality of the latter, we require not merely intuitions, but external intuitions. If, for example, we take the pure conceptions of relation, we find that one, for the purpose of presenting to the conception of substance something permanent in intuition corresponding thereto, and thus of demonstrating the objective reality of this conception, we require an intuition of matter in space, because space alone is permanent and determines things as such, while time, and with it all that is in the internal sense, is in a state of continual flow. 2. In order to represent change as the intuition corresponding to the conception of causality, we require the representation of motion as change in space. In fact, it is through it alone that changes, the possibility of which no pure understanding can perceive, are capable of being intuited. Change is the connection of determinations contradictorily opposed to each other in the existence of one and the same thing. Now, how it is possible that out of a given state one quite opposite to it in the same thing should follow, reason, without an example, can not only not conceive, but cannot even make intelligible without intuition. And this intuition is the motion of a point in space, the existence of which in different spaces, as a consequence of opposite determinations, alone makes the intuition of change possible. For, in order to make even internal change cognitable, we require to represent time as the form of the internal sense figuratively by a line, and the internal change by the drawing of that line, motion, and consequently are obliged to employ external intuition to be able to represent the successive existence of ourselves in different states. The proper ground of this fact is that all change to be perceived as change presupposes something permanent in intuition, while in the internal sense no permanent intuition is to be found. Lastly, the objective possibility of the category of community cannot be conceived by mere reason, and consequently its objective reality cannot be demonstrated without an intuition, and that external in space. For how can we conceive the possibility of community, that is, when several substances exist, that some effect on the existence of the one follows from the existence of the other and reciprocally, and therefore that, because something exists in the latter, something else must exist in the former, which could not be understood from its own existence alone? For this is the very essence of community, which is inconceivable as a property of things which are perfectly isolated. Hence Leibniz, in attributing to the substances of the world, as cogitated by the understanding alone, a community, required the mediating aid of a divinity, for, from their existence, such a property seemed to him with justice inconceivable. But we can very easily conceive the possibility of community, of substances as phenomena, if we represent them to ourselves as in space, consequently in external intuition. For external intuition contains in itself a priori formal external relations, as the conditions of the possibility of the real relations of action and reaction, and therefore of the possibility of community. With the same ease can it be demonstrated that the possibility of things as quantities, and consequently the objective reality of the category of quantity, can be grounded only in external intuition, and that by its means alone is the notion of quantity appropriated by the internal sense. But I must avoid prolixity and leave the task of illustrating this by examples to the reader's own reflection. The above remarks are of the greatest importance, not only for the confirmation of our previous confutation of idealism, but still more when the subject of self-cognition by mere internal consciousness and the determination of our own nature without the aid of external empirical intuitions is under discussion, for the indication of the grounds of the possibility of such a cognition. The result of the whole of this part of the Analytic of Principles is, therefore, all principles of the pure understanding are nothing more than a priori principles of the possibility of experience, and to experience alone do all a priori synthetical propositions apply and relate. Indeed, their possibility itself rests entirely on this relation. Chapter 3. Of the ground of the division of all objects into phenomena and noumena. We have now not only traversed the region of the pure understanding and carefully surveyed every part of it, but we have also measured it and assigned to everything therein its proper place. But this land is an island and enclosed by nature herself within unchangeable limits. It is the land of truth, an attractive word, surrounded by a wide and stormy ocean. The region of illusion, where many a fog bank, many an iceberg, seems to the mariner on his voyage of discovery a new country, and while constantly deluding him with vain hopes, engages him in dangerous adventures from which he never can desist, and which yet he never can bring to a termination. But before venturing upon this sea, in order to explore it in its whole extent and to arrive at a certainty whether anything is to be discovered there, it will not be without advantage if we cast our eyes upon the chart of the land that we are about to leave, and to ask ourselves, firstly, whether we cannot rest perfectly contented with what it contains, or whether we must not of necessity be contented with it if we can find nowhere else a solid foundation to build upon, and secondly, by what title we possess this land itself, and how we hold it secure against all hostile claims. Although, in the course of our analytic, we have already given sufficient answers to these questions, yet a summary recapitulation of these solutions may be useful in strengthening our conviction, by uniting in one point the momenta of the arguments. We have seen that everything which the understanding draws from itself, without borrowing from experience, it nevertheless possesses only for the behoof and use of experience. The principles of the pure understanding, whether constitutive a priori as the mathematical principles, or merely regulative as the dynamical, contain nothing but the pure schema, as it were, of possible experience. For experience possesses its unity from the synthetical unity which the understanding, originally and from itself, imparts to the synthesis of the imagination in relation to apperception, and in a priori relation to and agreement with which phenomena as data for a possible cognition must stand. But although these rules of the understanding are not only a priori true, but the very source of all truth, that is, of the accordance of our cognition with objects, and on this ground that they contain the basis of the possibility of experience as the ensemble of all cognition, it seems to us not enough to propound what is true. We desire also to be told what we want to know. If, then, we learn nothing more by this critical examination than what we should have practiced in the merely empirical use of the understanding, without any such subtle inquiry, the presumption is that the advantage we reap from it is not worth the labour bestowed upon it. It may certainly be answered that no rash curiosity is more prejudicial to the enlargement of our knowledge than that which must know beforehand the utility of this or that piece of information we seek, before we have entered on the needful investigations, and before one could form the least conception of its utility, even though it were placed before our eyes. But there is one advantage in such transcendental inquiries which can be made comprehensible to the dullest and most reluctant learner. This, namely, that the understanding which is occupied merely with empirical exercise and does not reflect on the sources of its own cognition, may exercise its functions very well and very successfully, but is quite unable to do one thing, and that of very great importance. To determine, namely, the bounds that limit its employment, and to know what lies within or without its own sphere. This purpose can be obtained only by such profound investigations as we have instituted. But if it cannot distinguish whether certain questions lie within its horizon or not, it can never be sure either as to its claims or possessions, but must lay its account with many humiliating corrections when it transgresses, as it unavoidably will, the limits of its own territory, and loses itself in fanciful opinions and blinding illusions. That the understanding, therefore, cannot make of its a priori principles, or even of its conceptions, other than an empirical use, is a proposition which leads to the most important results. A transcendental use is made of a conception in a fundamental proposition or principle when it is referred to things in general and considered as things in themselves. An empirical use, when it is referred merely to phenomena, that is, to objects of a possible experience. That the latter use of a conception is the only admissible one is evident from the reasons following. For every conception are requisite, firstly, the logical form of a conception of thought, general, and secondly, the possibility of presenting to this an object to which it may apply. Failing this latter, it has no sense, and utterly void of content, although it may contain a logical function for constructing a conception from certain data. Now, object cannot be given to a conception otherwise than by intuition, and even if a pure intuition antecedent to the object is a priori possible, this pure intuition can itself obtain objective validity only from empirical intuition, of which it is itself but the form. All conceptions, therefore, and with them all principles, however high the degree of their a priori possibility, relate to empirical intuitions, that is, to data towards a possible experience. Without this, they possess no objective validity, but are mere play of imagination or of understanding with images or notions. Let us take, for example, the conceptions of mathematics, and first in its pure intuitions. Space has three dimensions. Between two points there can be only one straight line, etc. Although all these principles and the representation of the object with which this science occupies itself are generated in the mind entirely a priori, they would nevertheless have no significance if we were not always able to exhibit their significance in and by means of phenomena, empirical objects. Hence, it is requisite that an abstract conception be made sensuous, that is, that an object corresponding to it in intuition be forthcoming, otherwise the conception remains, as we say, without sense, that is, without meaning. Mathematics fulfills this requirement by the construction of the figure, which is a phenomenon evident to the senses. The same science finds support and significance in number. This, in its turn, finds it in the fingers, or in counters, or in lines and points. The conception itself is always produced a priori, together with the synthetical principles or formulas from such conceptions. But the proper employment of them, and their application to objects, can exist nowhere but in experience, the possibility of which, as regards its form, they contain a priori. That this is also the case with all of the categories and the principles based upon them is evident from the fact that we cannot render intelligible the possibility of an object corresponding to them without having recourse to the conditions of sensibility, consequently to the form of phenomena, to which, as their only proper objects, their use must therefore be confined. Inasmuch as, if this condition is removed, all significance, that is, all relation to an object, disappears, and no example can be found to make it comprehensible what sort of things we ought to think under such conceptions. The conception of quantity cannot be explained except by saying that it is the determination of a thing whereby it can be cogitated how many times one is placed in it. But this how many times is based upon successive repetition, consequently upon time and the synthesis of the homogeneous therein. Reality, in contradistinction to negation, can be explained only by cogitating a time which is either filled therewith or is void. If I leave out the notion of permanence, which is existence in all time, there remains in the conception of substance nothing but the logical notion of subject. A notion of which I endeavour to realize by representing to myself something that can exist only as a subject. But not only am I perfectly ignorant of any conditions under which this logical prerogative can belong to a thing, I can make nothing out of the notion, and draw no inference from it, because no object to which to apply the conception is determined, and we consequently do not know whether it has any meaning at all. In like manner, if I leave out the notion of time, in which something follows upon some other thing in conformity with a rule, I can find nothing in the pure category, except that there is a something of such a sort that from it a conclusion may be drawn as to the existence of some other thing. But in this case, it would not only be impossible to distinguish between a cause and an effect, but as this power to draw conclusions requires conditions of which I am quite ignorant, the conception is not determined as to the mode in which it ought to apply to an object. The so-called principle, "everything that is contingent has a cause," comes with a gravity and self-assumed authority that seems to require no support from without. But, I ask, what is meant by contingent? The answer is that the non-existence of which is possible. But I should like very well to know by what means this possibility of non-existence is to be cognized if we do not represent to ourselves a succession in the series of phenomena, and in this succession an existence which follows a non-existence, or conversely, consequently change. For to say that the non-existence of a thing is not self-contradictory is a lame appeal to a logical condition, which is no doubt a necessary condition of the existence of the conception, but is far from being sufficient for the real objective possibility of non-existence. I can annihilate in thought every existing substance without self-contradiction, but I cannot infer from this their objective contingency in existence, that is to say, the possibility of their non-existence in itself. As regards the category of community, it may easily be inferred that, as the pure categories of substance and causality are incapable of a definition and explanation sufficient to determine their object without the aid of intuition, the category of reciprocal causality in the relation of substances to each other, commercium, is just as little susceptible thereof. Possibility, existence, and necessity, nobody has ever yet been able to explain without being guilty of manifest tautology, when the definition has been drawn entirely from the pure understanding. For the substitution of the logical possibility of the conception, the condition of which is that it be not self-contradictory for the transcendental possibility of things, the condition of which is that there be an object corresponding to the conception is a trick which can only deceive the inexperienced. See footnote. Footnote. In one word, to none of these conceptions belongs a corresponding object, and consequently their real possibility cannot be demonstrated if we take away sensuous intuition, the only intuition which we possess, and there then remains nothing but the logical possibility. That is, the fact that the conception or thought is possible, which, however, is not the question. What we want to know being whether it relates to an object and thus possesses any meaning. It follows incontestably that the pure conceptions of the understanding are incapable of transcendental and must always be of empirical use alone, and that the principles of the pure understanding relate only to the general conditions of a possible experience, to objects of the senses, and never to things in general, apart from the mode in which we intuit them. Transcendental analytic has accordingly this important result, to wit, that the understanding is competent, effect nothing a priori, except the anticipation of the form of a possible experience in general, and that, as that which is not phenomenon cannot be object of experience, it can never overstep the limits of sensibility, within which alone objects are presented to us. Its principles are merely principles of the exposition of phenomena, and the proud name of an ontology which professes to present synthetical cognitions a priori of things in general in a systematic doctrine must give place to the modest title of analytic of the pure understanding. Thought is the act of referring a given intuition to an object. If the mode of this intuition is unknown to us, the object is merely transcendental, and the conception of the understanding is employed only transcendentally, that is, to produce unity in the thought of a manifold in general. Now, a pure category in which all conditions of sensuous intuition, as the only intuition we possess, are abstracted, does not determine an object, but merely expresses the thought of an object in general, according to different modes. Now, to employ a conception, the function of judgment is required, by which an object is subsumed under the conception, consequently, the at least formal condition under which something can be given in intuition. Failing this condition of judgment, schema, subsumption is impossible, for there is in such a case nothing given which may be subsumed under the conception. The merely transcendental use of the categories is therefore, in fact, no use at all and has no determined, or even, as regards its form, determinable object. Hence it follows that the pure category is incompetent to establish a synthetical a priori principle, and that the principles of the pure understanding are only of empirical and never of transcendental use, and that beyond the sphere of possible experience no synthetical a priori principles are possible. It may be advisable, therefore, to express ourselves thus. The pure categories, apart from the formal conditions of sensibility, have a merely transcendental meaning, but are nevertheless not of transcendental use, because this is in itself impossible, inasmuch as all the conditions of any employment or use of them, in judgments, are absent, to wit, the formal conditions of the subsumption of an object under these conceptions. As therefore, in the character of pure categories, they must be employed empirically, and cannot be employed transcendentally, they are of no use at all, when separated from sensibility, that is, they cannot be applied to an object. They are merely the pure form of the employment of the understanding in respect of objects in general and of thought, without its being at the same time possible to think or to determine any object by their means. But there lurks at the foundation of this subject an illusion which it is very difficult to avoid. The categories are not based, as regards their origin, upon sensibility, like the forms of intuition, space, and time. They seem, therefore, to be capable of an application beyond the sphere of sensuous objects. But this is not the case. They are nothing but mere forms of thought, which contain only the logical faculty of uniting a priori in consciousness the manifold given in intuition. Apart, then, from the only intuition possible for us, they have still less meaning than the pure sensuous form, space and time, for through them an object is at least given, while a mode of connection of the manifold, when the intuition which alone gives the manifold is wanting, has no meaning at all. At the same time, when we designate certain objects as phenomena or sensuous existences, thus distinguishing our mode of intuiting them from their own nature as things in themselves, it is evident that by this very distinction we as it were place the latter, considered in this their own nature, although we do not so intuit them, in opposition to the former, or, on the other hand, we do so place other possible things which are not objects of our senses, but are cogitated by the understanding alone, and call them intelligible existences, noumena. Now the question arises whether the pure conceptions of our understanding do possess significance in respect of these latter, and may possibly be a mode of cognizing them. But we are met at the very commencement with an ambiguity which may easily occasion great misapprehension. The understanding, when it terms an object in a certain relation phenomenon, at the same time forms out of this relation a representation or notion of an object in itself, and hence believes that it can form also conceptions of such objects. Now, as the understanding possesses no other fundamental conceptions besides the categories, it takes for granted that an object considered as a thing in itself must be capable of being thought by means of these pure conceptions, and is thereby led to hold the perfectly undetermined conception of an intelligible existence, as something out of the sphere of our sensibility, for a determinate conception of an existence which we can cognize in some way or other by means of the understanding. If, by the term noumenon, we understand a thing so far as it is not an object of our sensuous intuition, thus making abstraction of our mode of intuiting it, this is a noumenon in the negative sense of the word. But if we understand by it an object of a non-sensuous intuition, we in this case assume a peculiar mode of intuition, an intellectual intuition, to wit, which does not, however, belong to us, of the very possibility of which we have no notion. And this is a noumenon in the positive sense. The doctrine of sensibility is also the doctrine of noumena in the negative sense, that is, of things which the understanding is obliged to cogitate apart from any relation to our mode of intuition, consequently not as mere phenomena, but as things in themselves. But the understanding at the same time comprehends that it cannot employ its categories for the consideration of things in themselves, because these possess significance only in relation to the unity of intuitions in space and time, and that they are competent to determine this unity by means of general a priori connecting conceptions only on account of the pure ideality of space and time. Where this unity of time is not to be met with, as is the case with noumena, the whole use, indeed, the whole meaning of the categories is entirely lost, for even the possibility of things to correspond to the categories is in this case incomprehensible. On this point, I need only refer the reader to what I have said at the commencement of the general remark appended to the foregoing chapter. Now, the possibility of a thing can never be proved from the fact that the conception of it is not self-contradictory, but only by means of an intuition corresponding to the conception. If, therefore, we wish to apply the categories to objects which cannot be regarded as phenomena, we must have an intuition different from the sensuous, and in this case, the objects would be a noumena in the positive sense of the word. Now, as such an intuition, that is, an intellectual intuition, is no part of our faculty of cognition, it is absolutely impossible for the categories to possess any application beyond the limits of experience. It may be true that there are intelligible existences to which our faculty of sensuous intuition has no relation and cannot be applied, but our conceptions of the understanding, as mere forms of thought for our sensuous intuition, do not extend to these. What, therefore, we call noumenon must be understood by us as such in a negative sense. If I take away from an empirical intuition all thought, by means of the categories, there remains no cognition of any object. For by means of mere intuition nothing is cogitated, and from the existence of such or such an affection of sensibility in me, it does not follow that this affection or representation has any relation to an object without me. But if I take away all intuition, there still remains the form of thought, that is, the mode of determining an object for the manifold of a possible intuition. Thus, the categories do in some measure really extend further than sensuous intuition, inasmuch as they think objects in general without regard to the mode of sensibility in which these objects are given. But they do not, for this reason, apply to and determine a wider sphere of objects, because we cannot assume that such can be given without presupposing the possibility of another than the sensuous mode of intuition, a supposition we are not justified in making. I call a conception problematical which contains in itself no contradiction, and which is connected with other cognitions as a limitation of given conceptions, but whose objective reality cannot be cognized in any manner. The conception of a noumenon, that is, of a thing which must be cogitated not as an object of sense, but as a thing in itself, solely through the pure understanding, is not self-contradictory, for we are not entitled to maintain that sensibility is the only possible mode of intuition. Nay, further, this conception is necessary to restrain sensuous intuition within the bounds of phenomena, and thus to limit the objective validity of sensuous cognition. For things in themselves, which lie beyond its province, are called noumena for the very purpose of indicating that this cognition does not extend its application to all that the understanding thinks. But, after all, the possibility of such noumena is quite incomprehensible and beyond the sphere of phenomena. All is, for us, a mere void. That is to say, we possess an understanding whose province does problematically extend beyond this sphere, but we do not possess an intuition, indeed, not even the conception of a possible intuition, by means of which objects beyond the region of sensibility could be given us, and in reference to which the understanding might be employed assertorically. The conception of a noumenon is therefore merely a limitative conception, and therefore only of negative use. But it is not an arbitrary or fictitious notion, but is connected with the limitation of sensibility, without, however, being capable of presenting us with any positive datum beyond this sphere. The division of objects into phenomena and noumena, and of the world into a mundus sensibilis and intelligibilis, is therefore quite inadmissible in a positive sense, although conceptions do certainly admit of such a division. For the class of noumena have no determinate object corresponding to them, and cannot therefore possess objective validity. If we abandon the senses, how can it be made conceivable that the categories, which are the only conceptions that could serve as conceptions for noumena, have any sense or meaning at all, inasmuch as something more than the mere unity of thought, namely a possible intuition, is requisite for their application to an object? The conception of a noumenon, considered as merely problematical, is, however, not only admissible, but as a limitative conception of sensibility, absolutely necessary. But in this case, a noumenon is not a particular intelligible object for our understanding. On the contrary, the kind of understanding to which it could belong is itself a problem, for we cannot form the most distant conception of the possibility of an understanding which should cognize an object, not discursively by means of categories, but intuitively in a non-sensuous intuition. Our understanding attains in this way a sort of negative extension. That is to say, it is not limited by, but rather limits sensibility, by giving the name of noumena to things not considered as phenomena, but as things in themselves. But it at the same time prescribes limits to itself, for it confesses itself unable to cognize these by means of the categories, and hence is compelled to cogitate them merely as an unknown something. I find, however, in the writings of modern authors, an entirely different use of the expressions mundus sensibilis and intelligibilis, which quite departs from the meaning of the ancients, an acceptation in which, indeed, there is to be found no difficulty, but which at the same time depends on mere verbal quibbling. According to this meaning, some have chosen to call the complex of phenomena, in so far as it is intuited, mundus sensibilis, but in so far as the connection thereof is cogitated according to general laws of thought, mundus intelligibilis. Astronomy, in so far as we mean by the word the mere observation of the starry heaven, may represent the former, a system of astronomy such as the Copernican or Newtonian the latter. But such twisting of words is a mere sophistical subterfuge to avoid a difficult question by modifying its meaning to suit our own convenience. To be sure, understanding and reason are employed in the cognition of phenomena, but the question is whether these can be applied when the object is not a phenomenon, and in this sense we regard it if it is cogitated as given to the understanding alone and not to the senses. The question, therefore, is whether, over and above the empirical use of the understanding, a transcendental use is possible which applies to the noumenon as an object. This question we have answered in the negative. When, therefore, we say the senses represent objects as they appear, the understanding as they are, the latter statement must not be understood in a transcendental, but only in an empirical signification. That is, as they must be represented in the complete connection of phenomena, and not according to what they may be, apart from their relation to possible experience, consequently not as objects of the pure understanding. For this must ever remain unknown to us. Nay, it is also quite unknown to us whether any such transcendental or extraordinary cognition is possible under any circumstances, at least whether it is possible by means of our categories. Understanding and sensibility with us can determine objects only in conjunction. If we separate them, we have intuitions without conceptions, or conceptions without intuitions. In both cases, representations which we cannot apply to any determinate object. If, after all our inquiries and explanations, anyone still hesitates to abandon the mere transcendental use of the categories, let him attempt to construct with them a synthetical proposition. It would, of course, be unnecessary for this purpose to construct an analytical proposition, for that does not extend the sphere of the understanding. But, being concerned only about what is cogitated in the conception itself, it leaves it quite undecided whether the conception has any relation to objects, or merely indicates the unity of thought, complete abstraction being made of the modi in which an object may be given. In such a proposition, it is sufficient for the understanding to know what lies in the conception. To what it applies is to it indifferent. The attempt must therefore be made with a synthetical and so-called transcendental principle. For example, everything that exists exists as substance, or everything that is contingent exists as an effect of some other thing, viz. Of its cause. Now I ask, whence can the understanding draw these synthetical propositions when the conceptions contained therein do not relate to possible experience, but to things in themselves, noumena? Where is to be found the third term, which is always requisite, pure sight in a synthetical proposition, which may connect in the same proposition conceptions which have no logical, analytical connection with each other? the proposition never will be demonstrated. Nay, more, the possibility of any such pure assertion never can be shown without making reference to the empirical use of the understanding, and thus, ipso facto, completely renouncing pure and non-sensuous judgment. Thus, the conception of pure and merely intelligible objects is completely void of all principles of its application, because we cannot imagine any mode in which they might be given, and the problematical thought which leaves a place open for them serves only, like a void space, to limit the use of empirical principles, without containing at the same time any other object of cognition beyond their sphere. Appendix. Of the equivocal nature or amphiboly of the conceptions of reflection from the confusion of the transcendental with the empirical use of the understanding. Reflection, reflexio, is not occupied about objects themselves for the purpose of directly obtaining conceptions of them, but is that state of the mind in which we set ourselves to discover the subjective conditions under which we obtain conceptions. It is the consciousness of the relation of given representations to the different sources or faculties of cognition, by which alone their relation to each other can be rightly determined. The first question which occurs in considering our representations is to what faculty of cognition do they belong? To the understanding or to the senses? Many judgments are admitted to be true from mere habit or inclination. But, because reflection neither proceeds nor follows, it is held to be a judgment that has its origin in the understanding. All judgments do not require examination, that is, investigation into the grounds of their truth. For, when they are immediately certain, for example, between two points there can be only one straight line, no better or less immediate test of their truth can be found than that which they themselves contain and express. But all judgment, nay, all comparisons, require reflection, that is, a distinction of the faculty of cognition to which the given conceptions belong. The act whereby I compare my representations with the faculty of cognition which originates them, and whereby I distinguish whether they are compared with each other as belonging to the pure understanding or to sensuous intuition, I term transcendental reflection. Now, the relations in which conceptions can stand to each other are those of identity and difference, agreement and opposition, of the internal and external, finally, of the determinable and the determining, matter and form. The proper determination of these relations rests on the question to what faculty of cognition they subjectively belong, whether to sensibility or understanding. For on the manner in which we solve this question depends the manner in which we must cogitate these relations. Before constructing any objective judgment, we compare the conceptions that are to be placed in the judgment, and observe whether there exists identity of many representations in one conception, if a general judgment is to be constructed, or difference, if a particular, whether there is agreement when affirmative, and opposition when negative judgments are to be constructed, and so on. For this reason, we ought to call these conceptions conceptions of comparison, conceptus comparationis. But as, when the question is not as to the logical form, but as to the content of conceptions, that is to say, whether the things themselves are identical or different, in agreement or opposition, and so on, the things can have a twofold relation to our faculty of cognition, to wit, a relation either to sensibility or to the understanding, and as on this relation depends their relation to each other, transcendental reflection, that is, the relation of given representations to one or the other faculty of cognition, can alone determine this latter relation. Thus, we shall not be able to discover whether the things are identical or different, in agreement or opposition, etc., from the mere conception of the things by means of comparison. Comparatio, but only by distinguishing the mode of cognition to which they belong, in other words, by means of transcendental reflection. We may therefore with justice say that logical reflection is mere comparison, for in it no account is taken of the faculty of cognition to which the given conceptions belong, and they are consequently, as far as regards their origin, to be treated as homogeneous, while transcendental reflection, which applies to the objects themselves, contains the ground of the possibility of objective comparison of representations with each other, and is therefore very different from the former, because the faculties of cognition to which they belong are not even the same. Transcendental reflection is a duty which no one can neglect who wishes to establish an a priori judgment upon things. We shall now proceed to fulfill this duty, and thereby throw not a little light on the question as to the determination of the proper business of the understanding. 1. Identity and difference. When an object is presented to us several times, but always with the same internal determinations, qualitas et quantitas, it, if an object of pure understanding, is always the same, not several things, but only one thing, numerica identitas. But if a phenomenon, we do not concern ourselves with comparing the conception of the thing with the conception of some other, but, although they may be in this respect perfectly the same, the difference of place at the same time is a sufficient ground for asserting the numerical difference of these